Blog Talk Radio.
Oh shoot.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on Facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbisn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Hi, and welcome to Brain Injury Radio. My name is Kelly Jones. I'm your co-host. We are on the third Sunday of every month. I'm a brain injury survivor and now life coach. My co-host, Dr. Valentina, is here. She's a bilingual clinical psychologist, and we're here to discuss the emotional aspects that coincide beyond physical injuries. Moving forward, we'll host candid discussions with persons who have experienced neuroinflammation and certified clinicians who have assisted survivors. Their insight on discovery, the line between pain tolerance and pain threshold, as well as pathways to success, will provide hope and more options on how to build momentum for sustainable recovery. Dr. Valentina, are you here tonight?
I'm here, Kelly. I'm here. How are you?
Good. Dr. Valentina, I have to apologize. Tonight, I was unable to access the site, so Kim put in the program, but we got a different song again.
Yes. I noticed.
I said, I don't know how to change this. I'm trying. And then I said, well, you know what? It won't last long, so we'll let it go.
Yes.
How was your week? Or how's your month?
Yeah, I know, right? It was good. It was actually really good. It went by super fast, but in the end, it's been really good as far as, you know, family, health, faith, life, business. Out here in Chicago, surprisingly, it was 50 degrees today. And, I mean, I always thought that February was the coldest month in the winter. So I don't know what's exactly going on. But that, too, has been pleasant, although, you know, concerning, confusing, you know.
Yeah. You know what the funny thing is? Everything's great. I was actually in two car accidents. Luckily, one, I watched my car get hit, and the second one,
wow.
I was actually parked when someone sideswiped it, and then actually reversed and swiped it again. So I got
what?
The jarring from the car being swiped in both directions, but
yeah,
you know, in a little pain, a little soreness, but moving forward.
Seriously, are you having to do any kind of therapy for it?
Yes, I thought it was She Woman at first, but then I went to the doctors and she was like, "No, you need to do this." So I'm going to be doing physical therapy. And
yes.
I'm doing lanolin patches and just a whole slew of stuff. And, you know, it's tough because I work out all the time. And
yes.
every time I start working out, I have to stop and start and stop and start and stop. It's frustrating.
Yes.
You know what?
It's hard to get in a habit that's not broken.
Yes, and the endorphins you get from working out, right?
Yes, that's real. That is so real.
Dr. Valentina, I wanted to ask you something. You know, we always talk about a subject in the news before we introduce our guest. I wanted to talk
mm-hmm.
to you about Representative Fetterman from Philadelphia.
Okay.
He just admitted himself into Walter Reed, and basically what they were saying is that after
mm-hmm.
his stroke, He wound up going to George Washington University, and basically he was suffering from malnutrition, dehydration. He was disoriented. Several different things are happening, but the therapy that he's going to be using is called talk therapy. He's going to be, please forgive me, at Walter Reed for anywhere from 2 weeks up to a maximum of 2 months. What are your thoughts on this whole thing of, you know, a public official, an elected official, coming out and saying, I need help?
Well, I don't really know the circumstances besides what you're telling me right now. So you're saying there was like a stroke, and then it's somehow like this physical, like medical issue turned psychological, although that's not completely shocking given what we've been learning on this show together, right, since we started at least half a year ago, which is that when people have these medical or physical issues that results in, like, this difference in ability, you know what I'm saying, this loss in ability, it results in, like, symptoms of depression because you now need other people and you know, depending on, like, just regardless, it don't even have to do with how the people react. Sometimes it's just the fact that you can't do what you used to be able to do. You feel this sense of loss. You grieve, you know what I'm saying, which mimics other symptoms of depression. And so it's not necessarily shocking that there is a connection, you know, this whole, like, checking yourself into a psychiatric hospital, I think is where it's more like, so I would want to know more about how that kind of jump occurred, because it feels more like a jump when, you know, just in general, when people experience loss, like, right, like, which is what comes with a stroke, you could, you know, you get into therapies like physical, but you can also get into a behavioral type therapies. But this psychiatric unit, that's like usually where people go when they are a risk to themselves and others. You know what I'm saying? At best, when there's some kind of mental, like, nervous breakdown. And so maybe that's kind of what, I don't know, again, all of the, like, details of this story, but to answer just the question that you pose as far as, you know, what are my impressions of, like, somebody in the limelight, you know, who is a public official, who is an example to others, who people look up to, who is a representative of others, right? This person would have been elected because of his trustworthiness, his ability to help people, you know, his empathic, his ability, you know, empathy. I say that, you know, it's better that the person be real and honest, which is seemingly what happened. You know, he voluntarily made his decision, and so I think that it's commendable. You know, I think that it's a good thing. I particularly am not very fond of psychiatric units, so I got some level of mixed feelings. But overall, I would say that what the person did was very strong, very amazing. You know, did the opposite of what, and that's because the person did the opposite of what he did, the opposite of what would be expected of Americans who have been sort of programmed to, you know what I'm saying, assume that a person who is seeking that type of help is something's wrong with them, you know? So if you seek that kind of help, something's wrong with you. And the problem is that there's a lot of stuff wrong with us, but it's not that it's innately wrong all the time. It's more like programming, like societal-wise, like culturally, right? Systemically, stuff is wrong, you know? So I appreciate it. I could say that. I appreciate him. Doing that,
I think it is phenomenal. I always say this, as you know, people give what's his name, Kanye West, a hard time for talking and saying all the things that he says. But look at Kanye West talking and still alive, and look at someone like Twitch who never said anything, and look at where he is today.
You know what though? I don't know about that not saying anything as far as Twitch. Well, I don't know if it's a platform or if we got the permission or
Dr. Valentina,
okay, but you do know he said something. Apparently, I mean, it's at least out there. Let's say this much. The people, the listeners know this much, that there was complaints about his, I don't know if she beat up. I guess I could just say his boss or whatever, Ellen DeGeneres. There was complaints about her. as a boss, as a supervisor, as the lead on the show, right? The show host, how she treated her staff, and apparently, like, it got to a high level, such that, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, the show went off air. Something happened. And so that was, like, part of supposedly the breakdown that he ended up having. Because oftentimes when you speak up, you know what I mean? Like, sometimes bad things happen. Oftentimes mm-hmm. when people speak up, you know? And so,
I don't know. I'm not going to say too much. Only thing I was going to say is that we know that speaking up can help people along the way. They can help people along the way. And like I said, Kanye talked a lot, but he's still here. So I wanted to introduce our guest, who is speaking up and talking in a major way for individuals with cerebral aneurysms. He is an advocate, mm-hmm. and he's making a mark. Actually, I had a chance to speak with Todd earlier this week. A little bit about Todd Helton. Todd Helton is the father of three vibrant girls. His oldest daughter is Ellie. Ellie experienced repetitive headaches and ocular migraines, but doctors were not sure of her actual diagnosis. Doctors began to go through a checklist of items while Todd did a lot of research on the fly. Fortunately, doctors at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill Children's Hospital took the time needed to discuss what was happening and the options for treatment at every step of the process. But time was of the essence, and her aneurysm ruptured. An estimated 6.7 million in the United States have an unruptured brain aneurysm, or 1 in 50 persons. A brain aneurysm ruptures every 18 minutes. Todd Helton, along with the B Foundation and the Brain Aneurysm Foundation, is advocating for the passing of Ellie's Law. H.R. 902 is in Congress now, and for more extensive cerebral aneurysm research. So Todd is joining us tonight on the show, and like I said, he is a phenomenal individual with a phenomenal story. Todd?
Hi, Kelly.
Are you here with
me? I'm here.
Excellent. Todd, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thank you for joining us on the show.
Yes.
Sure, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Todd has been sharing his story of hope and the opportunity for research with many people. Todd, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about Ellie and how your road to advocacy began.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So Ellie was our oldest, and you know, she was a quirky, kind of unique little soul. Loved people. Loved being around people, being with people dearly. You know, loved teenager things like pizza and Dr. Pepper and Reese's peanut butter cups, and was totally into the Harry Potter storyline and the Marvel movies and things of that nature. As I mentioned, she was our oldest. And so I was waking her on her second day of high school in 2014 when she suddenly put her hand to her forehead and just said, "Dad," and then just became unresponsive. And that's when the aneurysm ruptured. We didn't know she had the aneurysm. We didn't know anything about aneurysms really at that point in time. And as Kelly mentioned, you know, they're fairly rare in kids Ellie's age. So, you know, she'd had the headaches, she'd had the ocular migraines and things like that. But 14, a lot of hormonal things happening in a kid's body at that point in time. And with them being rare, you know, it's how I just describe it. Those are really my words. The doctors hadn't really gotten far enough down that checklist to get to brain aneurysm before it unfortunately ruptured. And after it ruptured, we found out that it was fairly large. They estimated it was about the size of a plum, and it was on her brain stem. So it would have been inoperable even if we had known about it. So in some ways, it's a blessing that we didn't, because, you know, she was able to live her life to the fullest for as long as she was with us. And 3 weeks before it ruptured, she spent 2 weeks hiking the Appalachian Trail. I'm pretty sure we would have let that kid get on that trail if we'd known she'd had an aneurysm. So, you know, so those kinds of things. And so, you know, obviously it was a very devastating loss for our family, my wife Karen and her and Ellie's two surviving sisters, Grace and Anna, who are now 19 and 16. And so, you know, 8 years ago, it sometimes seems like a lifetime ago, and sometimes seems like it was yesterday. So,
ask you something. You were saying that 3 weeks prior to her rupture, she went hiking. Did you see anything? I mean, your family seems very close from everything you're saying. Did you see any changes in her when you were hiking or prior to hiking or prior to the rupture?
No, she was her same personality. You know, she just had these headaches, and, you know, she was kind of a happy kid. So it didn't, you know, obviously when she had the headaches that impacted her in the moment, but it didn't really seem to get her down or prevent her from, you know, from living her life. She was at a summer camp, and that was part of the curriculum, was that she had the opportunity to hike that trail. And, you know, she did it without full permission, because why not? We didn't know anything was wrong. And I don't think we've ever looked at that and said, well, that was, you know, an aggravating factor in any way. And, you know, the week before it ruptured, we spent the week at the beach with my wife's entire family, which was good, because, you know, as things turned out, you know, we got home on a Saturday and it ruptured on a Tuesday, and she passed on a Wednesday. She got to spend, you know, some of her final days with really good quality family time and around her cousins and grandparents and aunts and uncles. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things. So,
Todd, was she having the headaches? Well, two questions. One, was she having the headaches every day? And how did she describe the headaches to you? Like, what was she saying about the pain that she was experiencing?
She wasn't having them every day. And I don't know that there was a really, you know, kind of trackable frequency to the headaches. You know, that morning when it ruptured, she'd come into our room and told us she wasn't feeling well. And so, you know, we let her lay back down for a little bit, and I went back in to check on her. And, you know, second day of school, you know, after summer break, after being on the beach, she may not want to go to school or whatever, but you could tell when I walked in and started talking to her that it was a bad headache. You know, but never in my wildest imagination thought it was going to be what it was, and that it was going to be that in just a matter of moments. And so, you know, it ruptured on that Tuesday morning, and she passed away around 6 p.m. the following evening. So 36 hours, you know, doctors, UNC Children's Hospital, University of North Carolina Children's Hospital in Chapel Hill, I mean, they fought right alongside us, and we prayed, and we did everything we could do and they could do. And they couldn't get the pressure to reduce. They are on medication. Every time they'd lower the medication, the pressure would ramp back up until it was just, they coiled the aneurysm, packed it full of these little titanium coils, trying to stop the bleeding to reduce the pressure. They actually, I think at one point, removed part of her skull to allow for swelling. And, you know, around 9 o'clock on that Wednesday morning, the surgeon came in and he said, I'm telling you, he sat us down and looked at us and he said, as a surgeon and as a father myself, I'm worried about your daughter. She's very sick. And that was really, we'd had some conversations on and off throughout the night. I spent the night at the hospital that night, the night of the rupture, and had conversations with doctors throughout the evening about, you know, potential brain damage and deficits and things. And, you know, I'm kind of an optimist. So I kept thinking, okay, we're going to survive. We're going to survive. And she's going to be in the hospital for a while, and we may have to deal with some long-term ramifications from this, but she's going to survive. Well, when he first sat us down and said that morning, then it started getting to be you know, okay, this may not be going in a direction we want it to go in. And then around 11 o'clock that morning, the chief of the, she was in the pediatric ICU because she was only 14. The chief of the PICU sat us down and said, you know, the essence of Ellie is no longer with us. And you need to prepare yourselves that she's probably not going to come home with you. And
what does
you
that
know,
mean,
just,
the essence of her? Like she wasn't
just
there
her,
anymore?
You know,
like
she wasn't there. You know, it just was, the damage was too severe. And it was irreversible. And it was, you know, it was going to, you know, soon lead to organ failure and ultimately death. And so, you know, our family, I'm from Southern Indiana. My wife is from Louisville, Kentucky. Our families came in right away. We're all there on that Tuesday night, and were with us all day in the hospital on that Wednesday. And we called our pastor, and our church folks came in, and she'd actually been making plans to be baptized church.
Wow.
And so we had her baptized in her hospital room as one of the last things that we did. And and so then family said goodbye, and it was just Karen, my wife Karen, and I in the room with her. And you know, that's a thing as a parent you never expect to have to say to somebody, to walk out and say, okay, it's time. And so they came and took her off life support, and her heart beat for 7 minutes after they took her off life support, and the doctor even commented about how strong her heart was, and that sums her up so well. Her heart for people, her love for people, you know, how strong her will was, because she persevered through a lot in her life. And so that's, you know, not the ending of the story we were hoping for once we knew what this was. And and so then, you know, it's kind of one of those, you know, you kind of going through the motions a little bit after something unexpected like this happens. And nobody, in our, you know, we had lost children in our extended family. So we didn't, you know, there's, you know, we're kind of figuring this out on the fly in terms of the processes. And so, you know, we knew we needed an obituary, and her cousins wrote her obituary. They're fantastic. It was a great little thing that they all put together. But I, you know, we talked about the fact that, you know, oftentimes you see in obituaries that, you know, in lieu of flowers, you can donate to X. And so I was literally the next morning just Googling Brain Aneurysm Foundation and found the Brain Aneurysm Foundation. And so we listed that in her obituary, and, you know, people were very generous in donating off of that, and starting, you know, her impact on this community from the beginning. And we knew we wanted to, you know, we knew in the coming days and weeks that we didn't want this to be for nothing. We wanted to tell her story and try to find good out of what had happened to us. And that, you know, the way we kind of talked about it was, if there's anything we could do to live in a world where this didn't happen to another family because of a brain aneurysm, then we needed to chip it, you know, to do our part to make sure that could happen. And so, you know, that kind of let us down. You know, a few weeks later, I have a friend who is a public policy attorney in D.C., wanted to take this on in a pro bono effort with his firm. And so Ellie's Law was kind of, you know, conceived, you know, probably by the fall of 2014, and it was introduced on her birthday in November of 2015 for the first time. And so, you know, we knew this was very much a marathon and not a sprint in terms of getting, you know, something like this through Congress and the process and things like that. So, you know, we've had that kind of parallel track, and we've had, you know, our involvement with first the Brain Aneurysm Foundation and now the B Foundation, and being, you know, being involved with those folks and their research and awareness efforts. We host a 5K every October in the Raleigh area to raise money for brain aneurysm research. And, you know, it's kind of a labor of love for us, but it's an outlet for us. It's an outlet you know, for our grief and a way to keep her story alive and share her story. And, you know, we also know we've met so many survivors and so many caregivers throughout this process. We also know that, you know, I think, what is it? It's, you know, something like 50% of people who have with a ruptured aneurysm survive it. And half of those people will have a long-term neurological deficit. So, you know, this is often a community of people who can't do things like host 5Ks and fundraisers and things because, you know, it's hard. It's hard for them to do that kind of thing. And so we're happy to do our part in helping that out. And there are a lot of other families that do this kind of thing as well. And God bless them because, you know, that money is so important for private research and trying to find solutions with this. So that's kind of a really long answer to a short question. So.
It was a perfect answer, actually. Let me ask, this is Dr. Valentina. Let me ask you this. So I know what Ellie's Law is, but can you share that in a little more detail with the group? And then after you do that, I want to just bring something because I was hoping that it entailed what it entails as well as something else. And I'm not seeing that it does, but that doesn't mean that it does. So that's why I kind of want you to break down, you know, what it entails so that we can, you know, the audience can hear.
Sure. So Ellie's Law was just reintroduced in the 118th Congress in the past few days. And it's named colloquially after Ellie, but she is one of five women who were named in the bill. And they are all, unfortunately, folks that we've lost to ruptured brain aneurysms. But what it allows for is $10 million per year for 5 years for research funding for the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. It's known as NIND, N-I-N-D-S. It's part of the NIH, and it focuses on unruptured intracranial aneurysms. And so that's kind of the short answer. It's House Resolution H.R. 902. The text has not been formally posted on the Congress site, congressional site, but it will be in the very near future, and we'll have the specifics. But it is really focused on brain aneurysm research, and it will dramatically increase the level of funding that the government provides. It's the most funding the federal government will ever have provided for brain aneurysm specific research. I think when you know, 2014, 2015, I think the government was spending about 83 cents for every person who had a ruptured aneurysm in federal funding. And I think now it's up to a couple of dollars per person, but, so we have a ways to go. This can really ramp that up very quickly, and it is needed so badly. I mean, this is not, these do not get a lot of attention. They're in terms of the level of attention you see for cancers and things like that. And I don't begrudge the cancer groups and organizations any penny that they get, because any kind of research that goes into health related things that impact people's lives, you know, is well worth the investment. We'd just like to see a little bit more come the brain aneurysm way.
Right. Okay, so let me ask. This is my follow-up question. So to the law, so it involves, like, so it's funding to fund, it's money to fund research. Does the research then mean, like is this coupled under that, or is it separate as far as ensuring that, like, this, what happened to her doesn't happen to other people? Because we have so many guests on the show, and Kelly could really speak to this, having had, you know, having been through the experience, you know, directly herself, that it's oftentimes missed. It's not even a part of the screening process. Like, it's something that if medical doctors aren't completely trained on, or maybe they get a class or a chapter in one class, you know, they just don't seem to recognize the signs, or if they do, they don't see the testing. I don't know if it's too expensive, you know. And so does this, and does it, and would it mean that, that it would be, you know, something that screams?
Yeah. So there's a couple, I think, a couple of layers to your question. There's the research kind of layer, and then there's the education layer. And I think we definitely need to find ways to better prepare our first responders to identify brain aneurysms and things like that. But that's going to be, that's going to need to be a separate effort. What this will do, and I think in some ways, like they're already through private research, there's some really interesting work that's being done around identifying blood markers that can indicate the presence of an aneurysm.
Right.
You know, so things of that nature, I mean, that would be a huge thing if that actually could be identified and be, become part of the regular, you know, discovery diagnosis regimen that that doctors, pediatricians, regular doctors, neurologists, ERs, you know, all can use that test in some way. And so, but they just need, they need money to continue to work on that. And so, that's the kind of thing I think we're really looking at is when you I think in relation to your question in terms of, you know, identification. And awareness, I think it's those, you know, those kinds of research efforts that could really pay real dividends going forward. Yeah. So.
And Todd, I was going to say that it, twofold. One, as far as the research, it's very expensive to go out and have an MRI or a CAT scan. So they are working on new procedures such as the 3D, the 3D scope of the brain, as well as the what is it, the Nautilus intrasaccular system, the one that tests the self-conforming scaffolding. It's kind of cool. Basically, what they do is they inject the, please forgive me, inject the coil, but the coil conforms. It can be customized to the individual that they're operating on. And then there's the other thing where they're testing the wall shear stress. There's like a mathematical equation now where they're able to look and see what the proximity would be or what the probability would be based on like the pressure that's going through, the pulsating, the level of blood is pulsating at, like whether or not it's, you know, whether or not it's going to create more pressure if it's pulsating at a rapid rate, at a rapid pace. It's the Hunt and Hess grading scale that they're using. Well, anyway, the bottom line is there's a bunch of tests that are being done or a bunch of procedures that are being assessed right now. That's one part of it. But the second part of it is actually getting the correct biomarkers to make sure that you're understanding who is and is not vulnerable. There was a test done, and I apologize, I put it in the notes. There was a test done with regards to African-Americans, and I believe it's African-Americans and Latinos, and basically what they were stating is that the biomarker that they were using or the genetic variants that they were using to see if someone was susceptible to an aneurysm was actually something that was very rare in African-Americans. It was more so found in Caucasians, but not African-Americans, because guess what? African-Americans don't do a lot of the clinical testing. So because we're not involved in research, they were not aware of the fact that the biomarker that they were looking for, the genetic variants that they were looking for, was not in African-Americans. So it's one, getting the equipment to make it more affordable to test more people, you know, so that when people come to the hospital, they're not like, oh, well, you know, every time I get into a car accident, as I just mentioned, I was in two, I have to have an MRI. That's not $1,900. So imagine me spending $3,800 in a week's time span. Because I have to have these MRIs. So with that being said, you know, think about how many kids fall, bump their heads, etc., and they don't go for testing because, you know, who's going to keep spending, you know, $1,900 for every single bump that happens? What football player is going to spend $1,900 for every single bump that happens? So, one, you have to make it more affordable so that people can have, you know, the repetitive testing that's needed. But then number two,
is you also have to look at what are you testing for? What are the indicators, making sure that there's a clear understanding that if there's a difference in women and men, because there's a higher probability of women having an aneurysm than there is for men. So what is the difference? Yes. Am I correct, Todd?
I'm sorry, say that again.
I said there's a higher probability of women having an aneurysm than there is men.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
Wow.
Which is also part of the reason that, you know, this kind of funding effort is important to us because, you know, I have a wife and two surviving daughters, and you know, a lot of times there's a familial history type of component to an aneurysm. And so we've all had MRAs, and those are incredibly hard to get approved. You know, we all don't, none of us show signs of an aneurysm. I think we've all been scanned at least twice at this point in time, probably due for another one in a couple of years. And so that's just going to be part of our medical workup, I think, going forward for the rest of our lives because of what happened with Ellie. But but maybe one of these days it's just a blood test. And, you know, that'd be a lot more effective, a lot more efficient, and a lot more cost effective in terms of insurance and things like that. So.
Yes. Right. And Todd, guess what? It's you, it's your kids, and then it's also going to be your grandkids. It's you know, it's generations that will have to be tested. I know that, you know, I was talking to my daughter, and, you know, she's afraid to have kids because she doesn't want her kids to have to go through the same thing. So there's a lot of emotional things that come along with this as well as, you know, the physical challenge.
There has to be. I mean, just to provide some level of comfort, and I mean, it's all common sense type of, you know, it's coming from a common sense place. This isn't coming from like a research place. So if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, right? That's why I'm making it a point, right? A disclaimer to say this. It just to me doesn't make sense that it would skip so many generations. So it just feels to me like if, you know, if they're good, like if dad's good. And mom's good, and siblings are good, and then, okay, let's give it another generation. They have children, and they're good, and maybe some will be like, well, it could skip a generation. Okay, so then the siblings have, you know, your daughters, right? Your remaining daughters have children, and they're good, and it's like, okay, I don't think that we need to, you know what I'm saying? Like, be worried. Like, I don't know. It just feels like if that's the case, then we ought to be worried about every single thing. Then it happens. Special test for every single issue because there's at some point someone in our family, you know, great 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 grandmama, you know, who had you see what I'm saying? Otherwise, it just feels like that's what you would have to do, and that just don't seem right. I'm glad, Dad, that you mentioned that. Not saying Dad, because I'm looking at you like that's what you are. I mean, you're an advocate, you know, and mainly because that was like your baby. Okay, so. This is just a trip, right? I mean, I'm sure. Can you describe some of the emotions? Because I'm experiencing some of the stuff right now, as far as shock, as far as like sadness. You know, I'm also feeling like some level of relief and accomplishment for you. You know what I'm saying? Some level of peace and joy. Can you describe some of those emotions that you know you and your children? I mean, this is like you had your own stuff, but then you probably had stuff because of the position you was in as the head of the household, caring for these damn children who, I don't know if your daughters were now worried, the moment they get one little headache because of lack of just sleep, right? Not getting sufficient sleep, not getting sufficient water. Now all of a sudden they're worried. Like, can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, obviously, you know, it's one of those, I mean, parents should not bury their kids. That's just, you know, life shouldn't be that way. But unfortunately, it is. And I think it is, it's how, you know, it's what you can do, how you handle it. You know, it's not like, I don't know, this is always a hard question for me to answer because I think it's, you know, as far as me, I mean, you know, being on the phone with 911 when she's still in her bedroom and I'm doing CPR on her. You know, I'm dad. I've got my hands on my kid. And I couldn't save her. I could not save her. You know, so there's there's that kind of, you know, there's those kinds of moments that pops into my mind, and I don't think that's ever going to leave me. I mean, that's just how it is. And, you know, just trying to make sure that our girls, and Karen and I also making sure for each one of us that we had and have space to grieve.
That's it.
Because, you know, as I've met more families like ours who've lost children to this, you know, I tell, or just families who've lost kids in general, and we come across them in one way or another. What I tell people is, you know, it doesn't get easier, the grief; it just gets different, because you just kind of evolves a little bit, and. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if it's an acceptance or what it is, but you just, this is what you have in your life. And, you know, the kids probably, you know, I can't speak for anybody else's kids, but I know Ellie wouldn't want us to come home and, you know, lock the doors and close the blinds and sit in a dark room and not do anything with our lives.
Right.
And
not
have peace and happiness and joyful moments and all that. And, you know, it's like when Karen and I first, not long after this happened, we started seeing a grief counselor for couples because we thought that was important to kind of find some time to do this together. And I remember, you know, the grief counselor describing, you know, when the grief gets really, really strong or really bad in moments, she would refer to that as going into the pit. And sometimes you just go into the pit. Sometimes you get dragged in there because of something that's popped into your head or an experience that reminds you of the person or whatever. And sometimes, you know, your mind just kind of takes you there. And it's just knowing that's going to happen, and it's going to happen whether I live another 5 years or another 50 years, that there are going to be times when I end up in that pit. And just being prepared for that. But it's also, you know, I remember not long after Ellie passed, we were at dinner one night, sitting at dinner one night. I think my in-laws were in town then because our families, they were and have been so good with us over the course of this. And I was praying for dinner then, and I prayed for God to use Ellie. And afterwards, Karen's like, she was kind of, you know, just praying about that. You want to put her to work? And I'm like, yes, I don't want this to be for nothing. You know, if she's going to go home to be with him, then use her. Use her in some way that makes a difference for somebody else. And I think, you know, it's funny. I have friends and coworkers and strangers who never met her who still will tell me to this day that they think of her often and that she has had a positive impact on their lives. These are adults. You know, something about her story has been embedded in them. And that is a source of comfort or inspiration or something. Or they see themselves in L.A. when they were 14 and kind of live that a little bit in their minds, I think. And they'll never understand, and I don't think I can ever verbalize it, what that means to us to hear. Because we haven't done all this to inspire or motivate or anything like that, but if that's happening for people, then fantastic.
Exactly.
Todd, you know what? I think people also see you as a loving and caring dad, and they can feel Ellie's story and Ellie's vibrance through you. Close relationship with your daughter shows. And I think that's also a powerful story today when you look at so many kids who are having challenges being engaged and being connected with their family. And you have something that a lot of people hope for. So, yes, Ellie's vibrance was amazing. You too, Todd. You are amazing. You're on this podcast because of you. You met with, you know, people in our office because of you and the way you tell the story. Ellie's law is being pushed forward or, you know, is becoming more visible because of you. So I thank God for you, your passion, your closeness, what you put into your relationship with Ellie to make us see and hear her story more vividly. So
you
are truly a hero in my book.
Coach KJ, I want to answer that because in the end, oftentimes people's stories do not get heard because their family members are so, downtrodden by the situation, like downtrodden, they're so grieved, they're so, angry and confused and like lost and sometimes you still feel those things, but this push, there's like this push, like you say, even if your anger is, well, this ain't going to be for nothing, and it helps push you to then seek out, this kind of law, this kind of effort, like either way, it's on the family members who are left, you know what I'm saying, to really get the person's story out here, because the person can't talk for themselves, you know what I'm saying, like, and so at the end, like, you really did her proud. You were doing her proud, you know?
How much would you say faith has played a role in your advocacy and your push?
Yeah.
Well, let me first say, I appreciate what you all just said about us and how we've done things. And I always look at that, and those are always very meaningful words to hear, and I don't mean to downplay them at all. I just think that's what you do as parents.
Yeah,
I think
good parents.
You do those things. That's just what you should do. What we've done. I think in terms of faith, I mean, man, that was everything to us in the beginning, especially. And just not, that was the place we turned because there was no other place to turn that had any kind of semblance of hope in our minds, in our hearts. And we thought that was really important. And, that still drives, I think, so much of what we do. But, our faith was what kept us together in those beginning months and first couple of years, because this was not, this is losing a child that's a hard thing for a family. That's probably maybe the hardest thing for a family to go through. And we wanted to make sure that our girls, our surviving daughters, had everything that they needed. And we just saw that as our pathway forward.
Wow. That's so huge.
We know that this has moved forward because you've got an audience. I mean, I think that there are people that speak up, but I don't think that they're as blessed with an opportunity to have an audience that's supporting them. I mean, Dr. Valentino, let's keep it real. In our community, a lot of times people say, you don't talk about that stuff, or you keep that quiet, or you know what I mean? They don't necessarily want to push a lot of the advocacy the way that you're pushing it, as far as health is, and even going to the doctors, to find out this kind of information. So what I was going to say is you're doing something really powerful with your advocacy and your petition. How can people get involved and help you push this forward? How can they sign the petition? How can they reach out to you? Tell me next steps.
So I'll talk about next steps, and I want to talk about this community of people a little bit if I could. Yeah. So next steps. So again, I mentioned that Ellie's Law has been reintroduced in the House. We're hopeful that at some point in time in the coming time frame, I don't know what that time frame is, it will be reintroduced in the Senate as well, because it's always had an accompanying bill in the Senate. But that has not been reintroduced yet. So Ellie's Law is HR 902. And if you have a couple of minutes, folks, if you could just go, if you know who your representative is, or you don't, you go find your representative, you could just reach out to their office and ask if they would sign on as a co-sponsor for Ellie's Law, HR 902. It's the lead sponsors are Congresswoman Yvette Clark from New York, who's been with us every step of the way on this. She's been a lead sponsor every year. Her sister-in-law, Teresa Lawrence, is one of the ladies that's named in the bill. And then Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick from Pennsylvania is the Republican lead sponsor. And so I think right now we have 18 sponsors or co-sponsors of the bill, mm-hmm. and we're hoping to grow that more and more every day.
Did you say the goal was 100?
The goal is as many as we can get. I don't want to cap it at 100. If 100 is great, but if we can get 400, mm-hmm. that's fine too. So, you know, because the more
the goal
more
is 435, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. So,
nice.
But you know, we're thrilled with the 18 mm-hmm. we have and the 19th and the 20th and anybody who comes yeah. after. And because we're just so appreciative of those folks willing to put their support behind what we're trying to do. And we'll keep coming back at it every year until we get this thing done. But when I say we, this leads me into this community because, you know, we've been fortunate to work with the Brain Aneurysm Foundation. We are honored and blessed to work with the B Foundation. Full disclosure, mm-hmm. I'm a board member for the B Foundation, but mm-hmm. it's a phenomenal organization. Founded by two sisters, Christine Condra and Aaron Kresel, after they lost their cousin, Jennifer Sedney, who's named in the bill as well, mm-hmm. Christmas Day of 2013. And the B Foundation is heavily involved in its own research funding efforts, mm-hmm. obviously advocacy efforts. You know, they spend a lot of time in D.C. talking up this this legislation, trying to get things moving forward as well.
Mm-hmm.
Awareness efforts, because that's the other thing, is people just, they don't know about
that's
brain aneurysms until it happens. And so how can you continue to educate the public on this and all those risk factors and all those statistics mm-hmm. that identify people. And then certainly mm-hmm. support. They have a virtual support group that meets the first Tuesday of every month. You can find out more about all this at bfoundation.org. But they're fantastic, and they're really doing God's work and trying to get this done. So,
can you spell that? Can you spell the B Foundation?
Sure, it's B-E-E, like the bumblebee, like the bumblebee, and foundation mm-hmm. is foundation.org. Kelly put me on the spot for a spelling test there, so I hope I got that all right. bfoundation.org.
I'm like, wait a minute. Are we talking about? I love it. Your daughters will laugh at that. That's for sure.
but they're doing great stuff, and we're, like I said, we're honored to be a part of them. But Kelly, you asked about our faith. You know, mm-hmm. I've talked for years now about these three F's mm-hmm. in our life that we have now: our faith, our family, and our friends. And this community of people is what gets us through this personally, and they make such a difference in this community, because so many of these family and friends, and our family is our blood family, but it's also a lot bigger now with a lot of friends who've become family mm-hmm. and who through this effort, there's so many people rowing this boat forward, and we're just honored to be part of the group, small part of the group trying to do this. And it's survivors, it's caregivers, it's family like us who've lost people, it's medical professionals, so many just amazing people trying to make a difference in lives already impacted and trying to lessen or prevent the impact on lives in the future.
Yeah, exactly.
Todd, would you like some people to join you on March 22nd?
Yes, so March 22nd, 23rd is Brain Aneurysm Advocacy Day in Washington. Mm-hmm. We're gonna hit the Capitol and have a bunch of meetings with members of Congress and senators and staffers and anybody who'll give us 15 minutes to listen about mm-hmm. Ellie's Law and see what kind of a difference that we can make that day. I believe the registration page it's a joint effort between the B Foundation and the Brain Aneurysm Foundation. I believe the registration for it is on the Brain Aneurysm Foundation website. And that is bafound.org. And I think you'll find the information for registration and everything all there. But it is a very powerful day. It's a very tiring day. So bring your energy. But it is a very powerful day as you sit there and listen to all of these people share their stories of the impact that brain aneurysms have had on their lives and the importance of this funding request and the impact that that will make going forward. And so I'm always so humbled and so much in awe to be around all these people who fly in from all over the country to participate in this day and just to hear their stories and see the rock stars that they all really are. That's part of what keeps us motivated to be involved and do as much as we can to support this community of people.
Right.
Well, Todd,
right.
You know, if there's any way that I can be there, you know, I would love to be of support too, especially as a survivor. Yeah. I'm very, very passionate about people learning. Learning and hearing my story is on my page if anybody has any questions about my story with regards to brain aneurysm. But once again, like I said, I would love to be there to help and support however I can. In the meantime, I'm guessing the two key things are, one, we need people to contact their congressman to support H.R. 902. Number two, we would like for people to see there, or you would like for people to be there on March 22nd, March 23rd. Is there a form letter anywhere? Like, you know how sometimes they'll have a, like, sign this petition?
Yes, there are, I'll have to look at that. I believe there's a letter that people can send requesting that, members of Congress can sign up. But Kelly, I'll find out about that. I'll send it to you. But yeah, it's you know, I hope this is the year we get this passed. Mm-hmm. And if it's not, then I'll be up there next year knocking on doors again. So we'll keep going at it.
Let's do it. Todd, if somebody wanted to have you come speak at their church, speak at a health fair, speak with, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists who, you know, for families who may be going through similar situations. If someone wanted to reach out to you, because once again, your story is powerful, how can they possibly reach you?
That's a good question. I've never really thought about that. I guess probably they can just shoot me an email. And my email address is todd.helton@gmail.com.
Nice.
Okay. Excellent. Todd, is there anything else that you would like to share with us? Or Dr. Valentina, do you have any last questions before we sign off tonight?
No questions. Just like I'm definitely in awe. I probably could come up with a bunch of questions. I definitely have some. I'm thinking about so much that he said. This is just incredible. I mean, I was trying to think of like some of the signs that he was talking about. He mentioned the two that she had, but that's so hard because is it that for everybody who has it, this could happen? Like, you know, and so if so, then these medical professionals really gotta, you know, make this just a part of, like he said, the wellness checkup, like, process, like physical something. I mean, this is one of those things where it's just like, how does it slip through? I mean, for parents, it's we don't know what we don't know, you know? We just probably give ibuprofen or we do whatever we do, and oftentimes you do, child complaining about it enough, you bring it up to the medical doctor. So it's just a trip, but I can definitely say I appreciate what you're doing. I think that you are just, you're really honoring your family, your daughter. Like, I wish that, like you said, we could kind of get ahead of it, and I wish it didn't take all of this funding to do that. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's just like, do it already, like, you know?
Right.
And, Todd, I was going to say that, as Dr. Valentina said, a lot of the questions as to why, how, you know, individual questions, I know that you've given us a lot tonight. But once again, retelling the story can also be tough, too, because, you know, it can jar memories. The reason why I asked beforehand, if anyone would like for you to come speak at their school or speak at their church or speak at their association, et cetera, to provide more insight is because when you're talking to an individual group, there are probably more questions that those groups are going to have that will pertain to their group that we're not even thinking of tonight. So that's why I said, you know, as far as like a public, you know, some type of public engagement. And also if you're speaking to those groups, if at that particular time, you may or may not have an answer, it will give you an opportunity to go back and get the answers that are needed for that particular group or help them find the pathway to get those answers. That's why I said, you know, one of the biggest things is if you're going to effectively create change, you have to be out in the crowd. Like you can't do it on the phone. Todd, if you sat on the phone all day, you just have a big phone bill. But if you sat on the phone all day, it wouldn't happen. That's why you're going to Washington, D.C.
Right.
And like I said, and for people who have questions, if you're just doing the phone dialogue or if you're just doing the, you know, whatever, the you know, just touching the surface, people may miss that nugget that is most crucial for their quality of life, for their best quality of life, or their children's best quality of life, et cetera. So that's why I said, Todd, we got to get you out. We got to get you out and about, you know, in front of people. And
happy to do it. Happy to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Todd, I just wanted to say thank you so much for being on the show tonight. You have provided a lot of insight. You have I'm quite sure you've given a lot of people food for thought as far as going back and asking the question. Let me ask you this. I'm sorry. That's the thing. If you could give the audience two or three questions that they should probably ask physicians when they're viewing their child, or two or three things that need greater clarification before they, you know, meet with their physician or whatever it would be, what would you say people should ask?
I don't know if I'm qualified to do that, but I will say that I think, you know, if they are, if you have a child that is suffering from headaches, pretty severe headaches, they are suffering from ocular migraines, you know, and there are some other things, you know, there are other warning signs that you can find on a couple of those websites I mentioned earlier in terms of symptoms and things like that. But if you're seeing those kinds of things popping up with any kind of regularity with your child, when you're in at the pediatrician, just broach the subject of an aneurysm, just to have the conversation. Because, you know, we don't blame our pediatrician. We don't blame our Ellie's eye doctor because they were doing the job the best that they knew how to do the job. You know, like that's why I said they didn't get down far enough down the checklist before we ran out of time. But I have every belief that we would have gotten to aneurysm if we'd had enough time, but it just didn't. That's just not normal. So they weren't looking at that. That would have been a complete shot in the dark for them to suddenly just say, well, what about a brain aneurysm? Because there just wasn't enough data there pointing in that direction. But, you know, doctors, you know, as we've seen, especially the last two or three years, they're overwhelmed. You know, those frontline doctors, there's so much going on medically with people these days and having to deal with insurance and things like that. You got to be your own advocate. And that's not saying they're not doing their job. It's just you've got to advocate for yourself. And so I think, you know, if you're seeing some of those things and you go to the B Foundation's website and you look at symptoms and things, and if your kid's having, you know, two or three of those things, it's probably just worth mentioning to the doctor just so you're planning it on their radar because that could save a life. So
you're right.
Well, Todd, thank you once again for everything. Dr. Valentino, you are phenomenal as always.
As you are.
Well, Kelly, I just want to say thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me and letting me spend some time talking about our story and brain aneurysms and this community of people who are just so many wonderful people. It's such an important cause, and it would be an important cause to us, you know, if we were brought into this one way or the other, even if it hadn't happened to us, because it's one that kind of flies under the radar, and we're just trying to do our part to kind of help it be more visible to people. So,
yes,
so thank you.
Thank right. you. Well, saving lives. Yeah. I mean, literally, you're saving lives. Like, wow.
Yes,
because
you're
making
are.
Sure this doesn't happen to anybody. Even, like, I love that. Kelly, that was the perfect question, Coach KJ, that you asked him. Because him saying, like, this is a question or something that you could bring up to the doc, like, that literally could save a life. You know?
Yeah. That's what it's about. So listen, guys, I just want to wish everybody a happy end of February and March until I speak with you again, Dr. Valentina. Todd, I you know you and I will be in contact, most definitely.
Yeah. Yep.
But thank you so much for everything. And I want to wish everybody an awesome evening. Like I said, rest of February. And
yes.
All right. All right. Good night, everyone.
Thanks.
All right, good night.
Thank you, everyone. Mm-hmm.